Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. An international group of researchers are attempting to bring some consensus to the diagnosis and management in the field of developmental dysplasia of the hip. Dr. Kishore Mulpuri, a paediatric orthopaedic surgeon, and Dr. Emily Schaefer, a postdoctoral research fellow, both from the British Columbia Children's Hospital in Vancouver, have joined with the International Hip Dysplasia Institute to write a narrative review of DDH for the MJA. You can find it at www.mja.com.au, where it is open access until Sunday, the 20th of May, 2018. Kishore and Emily are my special guests on the pod today. So, hip dysplasia, I guess the layperson would say a child's born with a dislocated hip. Isn't that the be-all and end-all of hip dysplasia?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the olden days, that's what people used to call this term as CDH, or congenital dislocation of the hip. And the belief was that children were born with this hip that is out of the socket. And the term gradually got changed to DDH, or dominant dysplasia of the hip, because for all you know, the ball could actually be in the socket when they're born, but gradually it'll go out because the socket is not covering the ball well. So it's actually a spectrum of hip problems where the ball could be out of the socket when they're born, or they could be what we call a milder degree of dysplasia, mm-hmm. where socket is not covering the ball well, and the ball can gradually go out of the socket.
Why are we calling it developmental dysplasia of the hip? Is that because it doesn't necessarily happen at birth, but can happen as they mature?
Yes, and you know, certainly some risk factors put them at more at risk of having dysplasia. And one of the things I think might be very relevant for Australia is there's a study done in Australia where they've shown swaddling might be related and increase probably the, you know, dysplasia, right, the dislocated hips.
Oh.
So you could have where the hip is, you know, not sort of, you know, it could be dysplastic, but gradually with time, the hip would dislocate, and that's why the term developmental dysplasia of the hip.
Is there an age where if a baby hasn't displayed dysplasia, they're not going to get it?
So that's a really good question. So I think typically you have not noticed any kind of dysplasia by the time they're two or three. We think it's unlikely that they may later on present with hip dysplasia. But that being said, no one's actually studied this on a longitudinal basis. And that's the reason why we have a registry now where we want to follow these children longitudinally to see who develops dysplasia and who doesn't. And the way we would know that probably is if all children get a hip x-ray, no matter whether they have dysplasia or not at age two, and then they have another one when they're 18 or 19 or 20. So we don't have that at the moment, but the only way we would is if you go back and sort of x-ray, or going forward, you x-ray all the normal children and look at that, then we might have an answer.
Okay.
But we think anecdotally that if the hips are sort of normal at age two or three and they don't have any dysplasia, they might be okay. And that might be different for children that are born with dysplasia, though. So if they're born with dysplasia, even if the hips are normal at age two,
yes,
or you've normalized them with treatment at age two, they can still go back to dysplasia mode as they grow. Some of those, that's why we need to sort of follow up till skeletal maturity to see some hips that were dysplastic or dislocated to start with became normal at two. How many of them actually turn into dysplasia as they grow?
And additionally, a lot of the, you know, current evidence that exists is retrospective.
Yes.
And so it naturally lends itself to all of these so-called late-presenting cases have reported simply after the fact that they were already found. So it's been very difficult to actually tell, you know, were these cases actually truly late-presenting, where a five-year-old walks in with two dislocated hips? Was that because they were missed in screening and they were actually dislocated previously, or were they truly a case where they did not dislocate until the age of five? And because their evidence is all retrospective to this point, we haven't been able to make that call definitively.
One of the messages that I got out of your review is that the evidence has been really mixed and that there's a lack of consensus. Why do you think that's so?
So, I mean, again, a lot of it has been the fact that there's a lack of clarity in how things are defined in terms of diagnostic criteria in different areas across surgeons, across centers. And again, also, like I mentioned previously, the fact that a lot of the evidence is retrospective. So we're really trying to look back at what's being reported from single center, retrospective, small studies that really aren't able to be compared because definitions maybe aren't fully reported in terms of what each study constitutes as a dislocated hip versus an unstable hip,
yeah,
and things like and just different practice variations among surgeons. A lot of it is down to, like, management choices are surgeon preference and somewhat subjective in nature, and it's led to all of this variation that has really caused it to be difficult to come up with any sort of consensus or formalized standardized pathway from screening to diagnosis to treatment.
What are the differences between hip instability, subluxation, and dislocation, and what are the treatment options for each of those categories?
I think the one that Emily nicely sort of brought in this manuscript and also in our discussions ever since we formed this study is the clarity around that as to what degree of dysplasia or dislocation you're talking about. So if you're merely talking about, say, an instability where the hip is actually not frankly out and you need to push the hip to go out, traditionally the term that we use for that is a Barlow positive hip. And that's where the divide is. So for example, I am one of the physicians that don't treat Barlow positive hips.
Okay.
I believe that the hip is in at rest. Why do I need to stress to push it out and then say I need to treat it? And there are some people that treat those hips, right?
Okay.
I mean, they would treat them with a harness. And in a hip that's frankly out, I think there is a little debate about whether that hips need treatment or not. Then the variability comes about what is the best brace to treat and how long do we treat them? Once the hip stabilizes and becomes normal, how long do you still continue to treat them with a brace and monitor?
Yeah.
And that's where some of the variability comes. And currently, even with our large multi-center study that we're looking at, there are huge practice variabilities between center to center and within the same center among different surgeons that contribute data in that center. So that's why we have this currently as an observational cohort where we're studying just the practice as they are. And once we have enough number, then we'd be able to compare where the trends are and where the equipoise is. And our goal is down the road that we would actually be looking at some hypothesis testing studies, possibly some randomized controlled trials, whether they are true randomized controlled trials versus center randomization versus surgeon randomization, based on the best feasible methodology to come up with answers for some of this.
Is screening every baby an option?
It depends, I guess, a lot on your health setting, your resources.
Yeah.
Screening every baby does happen both with clinical examination is essentially universal where babies are having routine well baby check and at birth. Ultrasound screening is also used universally in certain areas of the UK and other parts of Europe. So it's definitely possible, again, depending on your resource settings. Likewise, we were talking about the controversy in the evidence, is there isn't a lot of evidence one way or the other to support that universal screening with both clinical exam and ultrasound actually is more beneficial than, say, a selective screening program. And even there are certain studies that even suggest that no ultrasound screening is necessary, although that one's a more controversial stance. So it's definitely something that is possible in certain areas, but whether it truly reflects what's needed, it is a difficult call.
Are there any ways of preventing hip dysplasia before it happens?
Cases obviously that are truly from birth a hip dislocation, then not at all.
Mm.
But there's not enough, again, we're hoping, if we're able to identify, you know, rigorously with our prospective observational cohort study that we have going on now, with how large we're becoming as a study, with all these different centers, that we will be able to look at some of this prospectively and actually identify some prognostic factors or some risk factors with some clarity mm-hmm. and some definitive identification of these risk factors. If we're able to identify some of these risk factors, maybe there are cases of, say, the later presenting DDH that can actually be prevented before they occur.
Yeah.
But again, we don't have enough information now on these risk factors to be able to know that for sure.
Yeah. So we don't know, or do we, that there is some physiological deficit or something happening in the process in uteri that causes hips to be susceptible?
Yeah, you know, there are all sorts of theories people have put forward, but I don't think there is one that's been proven to be the case at this point in time that we could somehow look at, say, antenatal ultrasound or and determine that this hip would be, or some sort of blood test, and say this hip would be more at risk. And we don't have that.
You mentioned, Emily, about, you know, the resources that are available being important. Are babies in resource-poor settings disadvantaged if they have hip dysplasia in terms of treatment options?
One of the values of the current sort of registry-type study that we're now doing and expanding prospectively is we have several centers. We have, I believe, 5 or 6 centers in India that are contributing data to us.
Okay.
As well as we have a couple of hospitals in China that have just started contributing data to us. And so we can't say with any definitive clarity, you know, retrospectively yet. We're still in the early stages of data, but definitely those sort of resource-poor, some of the more resource-poor settings definitely have a higher incidence of, say, kids presenting after walking age with hip dysplasia. So in North America and large parts of Europe and even in Australia, the majority of patients will present with at least the more severe forms under a year of age prior to when they start walking.
Right.
Whereas in other areas of the world where there maybe aren't these resources to do on-the-ground clinical screening and ultrasound screening, more cases are diagnosed with kids at the age of, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 and above with dislocated hips. So
okay.
There can be a disadvantage there. And so we're hoping with some of this work with this study to sort of look at those differences and how we might be able to improve those differences and sort of bring those areas, their walking age dysplasia, down.
Let's talk a little bit about braces versus surgery. Where's the line in terms of a brace will do or this kid needs surgery? How do we make those decisions? Are there guidelines? Does it come down to a surgeon's preference or a physician's preference?
You know, that's a really good question. So I would say, I think what everybody would agree is, say, almost up to 6 months of age, you know, brace is the first line of treatment for mm-hmm. any dislocated hip that we diagnose. Whether it's a dislocated hip that's reducible or irreducible, and the brace effectiveness might be different, but everybody would agree that brace would be the first treatment. But where it comes beyond 6 months of age, there are some surgeons that we see even in our registry that try brace, and the success rate goes down. And we haven't really looked at that over the age of 6 months. We're beginning to take a look at that. And in fact, some surgeons feel like they want to study that on a prospective basis, all the ones that are more than 6 months of age, brace as the first line of treatment. But do have some surgeons beyond the age of 6 months that would straight say, I'm going to take this child to the operating room and I would do a closed reduction with an adductor tenotomy. If that fails, we'll do an open reduction. And then the next big divide would be in the open reduction, whether you would directly go to open reduction or try a closed,
mm-hmm.
what's the cutoff age? Again, very different. There are some surgeons that would say, you know, any child they see beyond 18 months of age, that they would straight ahead go to the open reduction because they know chance of closed reduction working and not requiring further surgery is less, so go ahead and do that. So, and in the brace, again, we have very different threshold for how long people would try brace as a treatment before they say the brace has not worked. Some would have a maximum of 3 weeks, and then they would abandon the brace treatment and then move to either closed reduction, if closed doesn't work, to an open reduction. And in some we find that go on to about 4, 5, 6 weeks, and occasionally had a success with a prolonged brace treatment. But majority, though, as it stands, would not brace longer than 3 weeks waiting for the hips to reduce. If the hips are not reduced in 3 weeks, they would abandon the brace treatment.
You've got an awful lot of unanswered questions, haven't you?
Yes.
What are the major, what are the urgent ones that need answering as soon as we can?
You know, one of the urgent ones that hopefully with this paper we're talking a little bit about, and you know, we actually have a dedicated publication that Emily is working on that hopefully we will publish soon, would be we need a standardized classification for DDH. If you look at all the papers, people use different terminology to describe the different pathology in DDH. So I think the number one would be a standardized classification, standardized description of what we're dealing with, so we're actually able to compare apples versus apples. So I would say that would be the step number one, that any journal that's publishing any research on DDH should be looking for a standardized language and standardized classification system. And then the next, I would say, would be some of the different things that we should look at is currently the way we're screening children, especially in systems that are largely publicly funded, that are struggling to keep up with the growing demand. You know, centers like, you know, Australia, you know, New Zealand, Canada, where majority of the care is delivered publicly and the public systems are really struggling, is to look at what are the best screening practices that we have and how often do we need to screen and how long do we need to screen. That with the current either AAP guidelines or I've been involved with developing AOS, American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeon guidelines, we are asking, you know, a lot of these risk factor babies to be screened, but we have not given guidance about how long do we need to screen them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the dosage of the screening that's required? Do they need just ultrasound at 6 weeks, versus an X-ray at 6 months and 1 year, or X-ray at 6 months, 1 year, and 2 years?
Yeah.
And with the observational data that we have prospectively, we might be able to design some of what follow-up is required trials. And for example, for risk factors that have an otherwise novel ultrasound, maybe all we need to do would be an X-ray at 1 year and or X-ray at 2 years, nothing else in between. Because at 2 years, if you find residual dysplasia, highly unlikely for a hip that's in to dislocate. And if you do find some residual dysplasia at, say, age two, still you might be able to treat with a lesser complex surgery, but you might be able to save the system of a lot of visits and X-rays. So there needs to be some questions, hard questions that need to be asked and answered. The other thing is there are different kinds of braces that people use. For example, in Australia, in Brisbane, they use a more of a rigid brace called a Dennis Brown splint. And it's thought that a rigid splint has a better success rate compared to a flexible brace. And, you know, one of the questions might be if the effectiveness of a rigid brace is better. We need to study that on a prospective basis, and we don't have that. That might be an easy question to answer. With a couple of hundred kids that are in a randomized controlled trial, we should be able to get a good answer about how much better is a rigid brace compared to a flexible brace like a pelvic harness. And then comes down to, you know, I mean, we call that, in, you know, as you know, in medical research, we can keep fine-tuning and generating evidence so we're improving with a goal of improving care and also improving efficiency within the system. And one of the, I would say, the thing that we all forget is when we live in this part of the world, when we start talking about ultrasound and some of the screening practices, a lot of what we have written in this paper and a lot of what's published in the literature in DDH is only relevant to 10% of the world. If you think about India, China, Africa, they don't have ultrasound that's readily available. I think we need to be thinking about care pathway developments, working with their pediatric society and engaging with their pediatric orthopedic surgeons, primary care. We need to come up with care pathways in those countries that might be very different than what we have. You know, how we're talking about ultrasound at 6 weeks and possibly an X-ray at 6 months, for risk factors in these countries like in India and China, Africa, are including our own countries where I would say the corner of, you know, Queensland,
yes,
and, you know, nook and corner of, say, British Columbia, it might be difficult to access ultrasound, but maybe an X-ray at 4 months in those settings might be equally effective. Those are the kind of things that we should be looking at to really globally making an impact for a common condition where every single baby that's born is actually screened for hip dysplasia. So I would say we have a lot of opportunities, and that's why we're actually trying to get a group together and think about different ways that, you know, different groups can work to answer not one question, multiple questions in the realm of dysplasia of the hip. One of the things that I would say is for us to be thinking about our research to be relevant more broadly, and also I would say for us to be thinking about how we can really help our colleagues in all different parts of the world through our research and research collaborations. And if there are any groups, whether it is in Australia or Canada or U.S., or whoever is listening to, if they're a part of an international study group, we need to be thinking about including these centers to have a true international representation, which is Africa, India, South America, China, Russia. We really need to be thinking more broadly. And traditionally, a lot of the international study groups have Australia, New Zealand, England, Canada, and U.S.
Yes.
And maybe Japan. So we need to be really think more broadly if we call ourselves that we are in the sort of realm of improving care globally.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, both of you. Added bonus to have you, Emily. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you both for your time.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks very okay. much.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.